The headlines: Iran's foreign minister proposes establishing a collective security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by Afghanistan's neighbors. Israeli forces stage a deadly attack on the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, killing 3 Palestinians and injuring 15 others. And the International Monetary Fund warns that the financial sanctions against Russia could undermine the domination of the U.S. dollar. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: China has hosted a multinational meeting of Afghanistan's neighbors to discuss the humanitarian crisis there. In his speech at the event, the Iranian foreign minister shared Tehran's viewpoints about the steps that need to be taken to restore peace and stability to the neighboring country. We'll discuss the challenges facing Afghanistan today with our guests in our news review program. Let's have a look. Iran's foreign minister says the long-time occupation of Afghanistan, as well as the wrong policies adopted by its occupiers, including the U.S., is the root cause of the problems gripping the country. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the invasion of Afghanistan did not contribute to its development or progress. Rather, it resulted in the current dire humanitarian situation. The top diplomat also warned against the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan, saying it could be traced to Washington. He proposed that a clear security mechanism be devised either by the existing organizations or an independent body in order to coordinate anti-terrorism policies. The Iranian foreign minister also called on the international community, especially neighboring countries, to join hands to ensure stability and security in Afghanistan. Amir Abdollahian made the comments at a speech at the third meeting of Afghanistan neighbors in China. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital, London. Mr. Mohsen Abbas, the Iranian foreign minister has offered establishing a collective security mechanism to combat terrorism in Afghanistan. How much can this initiative help fight the likes of Daesh in the country?
Firstly, I think the necessity of the security system is absolutely paramount, because without the security, we can't function as a nation. And so I think the emphasis by the Islamic Republic of Iran is spot on. Yes, economics is really important as well, but ultimately, if you can't have law and order and if you can't guarantee the security of the people, you will have no economy either, because people just simply won't be able to function. So this emphasis is vital. His emphasis on it being a regional cooperative effort is also vital, because if parties in the region are left out, then of course that will also be detrimental to any genuine security interests that could be established. The joker in the pack, of course, is ISK regarding security, and ISK being an extension of ISIS and Daesh, essentially, is the major problem in terms of security. And I think Iran will be pointing to that, and I'm sure that the Chinese and the Russians are very, very much aware of this, because ISK has been fundamentally responsible for destabilizing Afghanistan long before even the Americans left. And it's quite clear that what they've been financed to do, and the finance money trails, I'm afraid, do point to Washington. And their purpose has always been, it seems, to make sure that the Taliban or whoever comes into power in Afghanistan after the American withdrawal is not able to function without American, if you like, say-so. And I think that the other aspect which I think Iran has emphasized, which is really important to raise, is the humanitarian aspect. I mean, straight away, the Americans have been trying to impose, along with their allies, have been trying to impose sanctions. And the World Bank has even put 4 projects in Afghanistan just over the last week on hold. £600 million worth was put on hold simply because they disagreed with Afghanistan's school ban. Well, that's an internal affair of Afghanistan. It needs to be looked at in detail. You don't just cut off people's life aid The UK on Wednesday apparently pledged some money, $374 million, for life-saving food. That was a day ahead of the international conference seeking more than $4 billion, even as their supposed concerns over Taliban rule mount. What their concerns are is that the Taliban doesn't do what the Anglo-Zionist Empire wants. And the UN humanitarian appeal, just for the record, is the largest of a launch for a single country, and it's only 13% funded so far. I think the UN has said that there are roughly 23 million people experiencing acute hunger, and 95% of Afghans are not eating enough, while 10 million children are in urgent need of aid to survive. So you see, there's a dire situation, and it's been made worse immediately by Western sure. powers, more interested in economics than the actual plight of the Afghanist people.
Thanks a lot, journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. Moving on, fresh violence erupting in the occupied territories. Earlier today, Israeli military forces staged a deadly attack on the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. Forces riding in dozens of military vehicles stormed into the camp. Israeli snipers opened fire on the Palestinian residents from rooftops. The health ministry says at least three Palestinians have been killed and 15 others injured. An Israeli soldier has reportedly been injured as well. Meanwhile, Israeli forces say they've shot dead a Palestinian after he injured four Israelis in a stabbing attack near Beit La. The Islamic Jihad movement says it's mobilizing the Al-Quds Brigade's forces in response to the Israeli violence. There's been a fresh escalation in tensions across the occupied territories. On Tuesday night, a Palestinian man was gunned down after shooting dead five Israelis in a suburb of Tel Aviv. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnea tells us what the latest escalation of tensions in the occupied territory signifies.
We have seen in the recent event what's happening in Palestine is how the Palestinians, who are supposed to be living among the Israelis, are showing how the cause of the Palestinian people has never been completely crushed and forgotten. The Israelis feel they are not accountable to anyone in the world. They are allowed to do whatever they want. Over 175 UN resolutions were issued throughout the decades in favor of the Palestinians. All the settlements that are built by the Israelis are widely not recognized, and yet the Israelis continue year after year building settlements illegally and rebuffing the international laws. This is exactly what the Americans are doing and have been doing by occupying countries and by interfering in other states, imposing regime changes or trying regime change in different parts of the world.
Meantime, Palestinian resistance groups are calling on political factions to overcome divisions and adopt a unified strategy to resist the Israeli regime. In a statement issued on the occasion of Land Day in Palestine, resistance groups have said political factions need to follow the lead of the Palestinian people, who are united in resisting the Israeli occupation, settlement expansions, and racial discrimination. They've also criticized a recent meeting in the Negev Desert between Israeli officials and foreign ministers from several Arab countries. The resistance groups say those Arab governments need to fulfill their responsibility towards the Palestinian people and stop the Israeli crimes instead of racing to meet with Israeli officials. People in Gaza and the West Bank commemorated Land Day on Wednesday. Members and supporters of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas have held a ceremony in southern Lebanon to mark the 46th anniversary of Land Day in Palestine. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh took part in the event and filed this report.
Islamic resistance movement Hamas in Lebanon held a mass rally to commemorate Land Day in the southern town of Saida. Hamas leaders considered this event as an occasion not only to remember Palestine, but a day to resist.
Land Day has become more significant with the qualitative operations which are occurring in Palestine, especially the last operation, which is the slogan for the upcoming phase. This will be the state of Palestinians in the West Bank, in Al-Quds, in the lands of 1948, the state of declared and continuous struggle against the Zionist enemy, backed by a capable resistance in Gaza. Land Day this year is being commemorated with an aroma of victory, of heroic endeavors to prove that the land is ours.
Hamas also says Israeli policies of annexing land and building settlements have not stopped the Palestinian nationals from their struggle.
Today, the Palestinian people and behind them, the Palestinian resistance, are sending a message to the Zionist entity that Palestinian land will not change its identity. This land will remain Palestinian, Arab and Muslim, and the Zionist occupation, with all its crimes and swallowing of more land and building settlements, will not be able to change the national identity of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, many of whom were born and raised in Lebanon, say they grow more attached to Palestine day by day. Every generation becomes even more determined to return.
In the Meya Meya refugee camp in Saida, the youth, the men and women, everyone were joyous and cheering after they heard of the excellent operation. They were even saying that liberation is near and that Eid has come earlier this year. This was the situation in all the camps, and this proves that day by day our children, women and men are attached to the land of Palestine and have more hope in liberation.
Speakers at the rally stressed that the resistance in Palestine is stronger than ever, with the support it has from the entire resistance alliance in the region.
Land Day is commemorated by Palestinians all over the world as a pivotal date to mark their attachment to their land. With recent unprecedented events, the people's resistance, even in land occupied by Israel in 1948, is growing more vibrant, making the dream of liberating Palestine more possible than any time in the past. Maryam Saleh, South Lebanon.
And now turning to the latest developments on the ground in Ukraine with the Russian military operation now in its fifth week. The pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine are reporting significant progress. These forces claim they're in control of almost all of the Luhansk and more than half of the Donetsk region. They controlled about a third of each of the two regions before the Kremlin recognized their independence last month. Moscow has said a full liberation of these territories is now a primary goal as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded. And on the Ukrainian side, the government says its forces are preparing to ward off new Russian attacks in the east. Russian forces have encircled the southern port city of Mariupol. They've announced a local ceasefire in the city for Thursday to allow civilians to be evacuated. Ukraine says it's sending a convoy of buses to evacuate them. Meanwhile, on the diplomatic front, positive signs seem to be emerging following talks between Russia and Ukraine in Istanbul this week. Now, Turkey says a high-level meeting between the two sides might be on the cards. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu says there's a possibility of his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts meeting within 2 weeks. According to Çavuşoğlu, the Istanbul talks have been the most significant progress in efforts to end the war. The positive comments echo those by Russian officials about Ukraine being prepared to meet Moscow's core demands. The Russian lead negotiator has said that if Kiev sticks to its promises, the threat of NATO expansion to Ukraine will be removed. A senior Ukrainian negotiator has confirmed that the talks are to resume online on Friday. And staying with news about the economic fallout of the Ukraine conflict, the International Monetary Fund is warning that the financial sanctions against Russia could make the U.S. dollar a less dominant currency. IMF Deputy Director Geeta Gopinath says the Western sanctions could result in a more fragmented international monetary system that might lead states toward using digital finances such as cryptocurrencies or stable coins. According to the IMF official, using other currencies on global trade could push national central banks to diversify their reserve assets. Elsewhere, Yemen has dismissed the Saudi-led coalition's announcement of a halt in military operation, saying there will be no peace unless the brutal siege of the country by the coalition is lifted. Army spokesman Yahya Sarey made the remarks in a tweet. His remark came after Yemen's Supreme Political Council issued a statement expressing dismay over the coalition's announcement of a ceasefire without lifting the siege. The statement emphasized that there could be no peace unless the blockade of Yemen ends. The council said Yemen reserves a right to take necessary military and political measures to restore its legitimate rights. It also expressed regret that the coalition did not give a clear answer to Yemen's peace initiative. The coalition's truce came after Yemen's Ansarullah movement offered a unilateral 3-day ceasefire and a peace initiative calling on Riyadh to immediately stop its attacks and the siege of the country. Well, Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has launched its official annual report regarding the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing Saudi siege. The report concludes that the Saudi-led coalition committed thousands of war crimes during 7 years of war. Abdul Latif Al-Washani has more in this report.
The Saudi siege, a war crime and a genocide, is the title of the seventh official report published by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights in the capital Sana'a. The report highlights the impact of the Saudi blockade on the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was clear in his speech when he said that we will not stand idly by and we will not allow this siege to continue to Saudi Arabia and its allies, that we will use our right to respond. Any country has to protect its citizens. Therefore, I believe that the coming days are fraught with surprises. Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen and prevents the entry of food, medicine, and fuel, and this is genocide.
Officials say the Saudi-led coalition has committed thousands of war crimes against Yemeni women and children during 7 years of war. They also say Riyadh's breach of international law is covered up politically by the United Nations.
We've entered the eighth year. Saudi-led coalition is still committing war crimes against Yemenis, especially the siege, which takes more lives than airstrikes. Public services, especially the health sector, have been greatly affected by the lack of fuel, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients. Unfortunately, the United Nations provides the political cover-up for the illegal acts of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. The United Nations describes war-torn Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but has taken no action to end this humanitarian catastrophe.
Observers say Saudi Arabia is still committing war crimes as it refuses to lift the siege on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of food and medicine and causing more lives, especially for patients, amid the collapse of the health sector and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of the speech delivered on March 10th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with God on earth. You're very welcome, honorable gentlemen and dear brothers. It gladdens me to see that this is a very important meeting has been organized at the appointed time with the participation of all the friends. According to Mr. Raisi's report, the discussions are followed up seriously. I hope that God will help you and accept your endeavors. I wish to congratulate you on the Sha'bani Eids, in particular the 15th of Sha'ban Eid, which is the day when the dreams of the entire humanity throughout history blossom. I hope that God, the Exalted, will show us that day, the day of the reappearance. And I hope that it will happen very soon. Even excluding these Eids, the month of Sha'ban would remain a very important month.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The month when the Holy Prophet, greetings be upon him, and his household, fasted and kept a vigil with great enthusiasm, and he showed great humility in respecting and commemorating this month, day and night, and he did so until his demise. The Holy Prophet would treat this month like this until the end of his life. In the Sha'baniyya prayer we read, O God, aid us in following his tradition. This exciting prayer that has been narrated in this month is a sign of the greatness of this month. The sections that exist in this holy and dear prayer have very few peers. Of course, all the prayers that have been narrated by the Imams, greetings be upon them, are meaningful and instructive. All of them are extraordinary, those who are clearly narrated by the Imams, but this prayer really has few peers.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that abused Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest Indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit Nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value, in that it would show that the church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control Indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the Indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate Indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion, to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words?
Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
Thousands of Yemenis have staged mass protests across the country, including the capital Sana'a, on the National Day of Resilience, the day when the Saudi-led coalition began its aggression on Yemen. The demonstrators marked the seventh anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country, denounced the aggression, and expressed their support for resistance against the Saudi-led invasion. The demonstrations followed a wave of retaliatory drone and missile attacks that hit targets across Saudi Arabia.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company, Aramco, were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. This is the Yemeni army's highest profile attack yet on the kingdom. The army vowed to continue the retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Retaliatory missile and drone strikes against oil storage facilities in Saudi Arabia rekindled concerns over supply shortages as crude oil prices surged and broke the $120 level. The news added fuel to the already volatile oil market, shadowed by supply risks related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against Yemen, targeting the country's facilities in the provinces of Hodeidah and Sana'a, killing at least eight people. The coalition has hit oil facilities in Hodeidah. That violates a 2018 ceasefire deal that ended months of fighting in the city, which handles about 70% of Yemen's commercial and humanitarian imports. The air raids also hit the nearby Port Salif, also on the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia's warmongering policies in Yemen have so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, injured tens of thousands, and displaced millions. However, the war has stopped well shy of its goals, as the Yemeni army is gaining momentum by striking a heavy blow against the Riyadh regime. It's high time Saudis realize that they are on the losing side of the war, one in which militarily they are defeated while endangering their jewel, Aramco.
Certainly, they are losing this war. The Yemeni government, the Yemeni military is growing in strength since the beginning of the war. They are developing their own weapons and also relying on their allies to provide them with weapons. This recent strike was very targeted, very calculated, and was a big surprise to Saudi Arabia.
Yemen Yemen has announced a three-day unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Mashat said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Following Mashat's declaration, the spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Mohammed Abdulsalam, took to Twitter, urging Saudi Arabia to show a positive reaction to the announcement and prove that it's serious about peace. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
The United States should be supporting the people of Yemen in this war of aggression against them, but instead it is supporting the very powerful Saudi government. And it is, as you said, providing bombs, other weaponry, logistics, all kinds of aid to Saudi Arabia in their brutal and illegal war of aggression against the people of Yemen.
It has been around a month since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has shown unabated support for Kyiv by denouncing Moscow's actions, providing military equipment for Ukraine, and the biased coverage of the war by Western media. Conversely, Western nations have seemingly forgotten that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, one that the U.S. and several Western states have contributed to its making by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi-led coalition.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched on the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories, and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand. In recent days, Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up, but it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we find that Imam Musa al-Kazim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kazim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام لا دين لمن لا مروة له.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, he who has no valorous qualities has no religion.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the beautiful conversations and dialogues of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that these beautiful dialogues and conversations with his companions and his relatives and his friends and the people around him were so profound and so beautiful and had this world of meaning in these conversations and these dialogues. In one such conversation with one of his companions, we find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam advised his followers and his companions and those who believed in him as a divinely appointed imam, to consult each other in respects to their affairs and to not be obstinate and stubborn. And so we find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam said to his followers, whoever consults with others is praised during correctness, and whoever consults with others is excused during committing a mistake. Now, this is such a beautiful statement that we find in this dialogue of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam with his companions and his followers and talking about the importance of consulting with others. Now, just as a precursor, we must remember that we're not talking about consulting with anybody, you know, and everyone. Of course, there are certain people that you consult with over specific matters. So, for example, you're not going to necessarily go and consult with your doctor about whom you should marry. Or likewise, you're not going to go and consult your car mechanic for example, health advice, right? You go and you consult with people based upon their expertise. Now, moving forward from here, whoever, as Imam Al-Kadhim says, whoever consults is praised during correctness. Because when you make a correct decision or you took a correct path, well, because you had asked advice from others, you had consulted experts, and so therefore, when you do take the correct path, this is praiseworthy. But on the other hand, if you are stubborn and obstinate, and you don't want to listen to other people, you think that you are always correct, and therefore you don't consult with others, you don't take other people's advice, you don't take expert advice, well, then you commit a mistake and you didn't consult others, then that is your fault. You should have consulted somebody. But on the other hand, if you committed a mistake but you did consult other people, you did take the advice of other people, well, then you are excused because you did try your best. So this is the importance of consulting experts and taking the advice of experts in the different parts and aspects and matters of our life. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program. And at this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
The life of the seventh Imam is quite unique, as they say that he was the Imam for the longest period of time compared to other Imams. His Imamat period was about 35 years, which seems to be the longest compared to all the other Imams. For about 20 years, he was in the service of his father. As we all know, the sixth Imam, the renowned personality of the sixth Imam, how influential he was for the entire Ummah, for the entire Islam that we have or that we have remained today, is indebted to the sixth Imam, whether that be the school of Shafi'i, Maliki, Hanbali, or Hanafi. They are all indebted to our sixth Imam for enhancing them with jurisprudential principles, with Islamic knowledge that they themselves eventually started to carry out ijtihad and form their own schools.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.